And I'll just, let me just say before I introduce our speakers, but I'll also tell you what their titles are. So Susan Aguilar is a doctoral student here at the Graduate Theological Union, and her title is Seder Nashim, a 16th century book for women and its cultural context. Daniela Farah, did I say that right? Is a graduate student in Jewish studies?
Jewish history
at Stanford University, and her talk will be on the Jews of Iran in historical perspective. And Sarah Levin, are you still in the joint doctor program? No.
I don't know.
We're not exactly sure.
She is, but the program.
I think she might be. Are you the last student in the late lamented joint doctoral program in Jewish studies of the Graduate Theological Union and UC Berkeley, or possibly the other order? And her talk is titled Ambivalent Laughter Among Jews and Muslims in Morocco's Atlas Mountains. So let's please welcome our speaker. Thank you. So Susan, take it away.
Okay. So, Seder Nashim. This opening paragraph states, Seder Nashim, a sidur de mujeres en Ladino para todo el año, con su orden de Berakot al fin. And then goes on with a brief explanation and finishes, y al fin un alef bet con los puntos que abogan en el Ladino para que luego pongan mano en la obra del abesar a sus hijas y no se estorben en irla a buscar. Gives you a little flavor of what that would sound like. Seder Nashim, in English, a sidur for women in Ladino for the whole year with its order for the blessings at the end, and the order for the washing of hands and many other laws necessary in each case with respect to what happens. And at the end, an alphabet with the points in Ladino so that later they put their hand to the work of teaching their daughters and they are not preoccupied to go to search. This is the opening paragraph of Seder Nashim, a 16th century book published in Salonika that is both a prayer book and a didactic treatise intended to provide Sephardic women with the basic knowledge they needed to run a halakhically observant household. But rather than merely reading Seder Nashim as a woman's prayer book, I will argue that a close reading of it reveals at least three sites of anxiety for the diasporic Jews of early modern Salonika: the rupture in communal and familial relationships, resulting in a loss of religious knowledge and observance; the intercommunal tensions posed by a hybrid society reflecting multiple Jewish traditions; and tensions between women's traditional prayer practices and rabbinic norms. The opening paragraph actually serves as the first of two introductions, the second of which is written in Hebrew, not Ladino. And from its opening pages, then, this book signals who its audience is, men, women, or both, through linguistic choices. Ladino, vernacular Spanish written in Hebrew letters, was meant to be read to women or girls, or men who lacked facility in Hebrew. The Hebrew was directed to men. Yet even within the Ladino passages, certain religious terms are provided in Hebrew, such as sidur, brakot, dinim, and aleph bet. And then there's the word abogan, apparently from the infinitive abogar, but which does not appear in any Judeo-Spanish dictionary. In Castilian Spanish, it means to advocate for, to intercede, or to defend. And as used here in this introduction, abogan appears to refer to a means of vocalization, such as is provided by nikud, vowel points, in written Hebrew. And it's as if to say the nikud intercede and speak for the Hebrew letters, and therefore represents this very creative use of Castilian Spanish to express and explain a Jewish concept. Thus, within the opening paragraph, the author makes use of Ladino, Hebrew, and Castilian Spanish, acknowledging a kind of linguistic and cultural fluidity or permeability for both men and women in this early post-expulsion generation of Iberian Jews in the Eastern diaspora. It is this cultural permeability that I focus on in this paper, and I argue that Seder Nashim should be understood as a purposeful response to the particular challenges to cultural and religious identity that Sephardic Jews faced in Salonika during the 16th century. Seder Nashim was written by Rabbi Meir ben Samuel ben Benisti, of Salonika, and was probably printed by Yosef ben Yitzhak Yabetz in either 1550 or 1568. We know very little about the book itself, but we do know that Rabbi Benvenisti was also the author of Shulchan HaPanim, published in 1568, a Ladino edition of Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. And in the introduction to Benvenisti's Shulchan, he mentions that he had composed a Sidur para Mujeres, a prayer book for women. In fact, his Seder Nashim bears many similarities to the Shulchan Aruch, especially in its effort to provide a step-by-step guide to prayers and rituals to be followed throughout the day and the year. And we know of only a few books written specifically for Jewish women in the medieval or early modern eras, all of them composed in their local vernaculars. For example, a Provençal Esther poem written by Crescas de Calar, or Caslari, circa 1327, exists in fragmentary condition today. It recasts the Purim story of Esther in a highly romanticized style, intended for women's entertainment. Its author boasted it would be enjoyed by grandmothers, women, and children throughout the generations. The Ladino Sidur Tefillot, also published in the 16th century, contains prayers for women, but not instruction in ritual. And this beloved 17th century Tzenorena, the Yiddish adaptation of Jewish texts and stories for women, also does not emphasize or include instruction in ritual. But in contrast, Rabbi Benvenisti's Seder Nashim specified that women should be educated in halakhic norms, and that it was her husband or father's duty to teach them. Y cada uno podrá ser rabbi de su hija, and each can be a rabbi to his daughter. The only known copy of this book is held by the National Library of Israel. Several linguistic studies of Seder Nashim have been published by Ora Schwarzwald, among others, and her book, Sidur para Mujeres en Ladino, provides a translation of the book into Hebrew and Spanish, but to date, no English translation has been published. Schwarzwald has noted that Rabbi Benvenisti was concerned for the lack of religious knowledge in both men and women, and that was his motivation for his writings. I want today to take her observations a little further through a consideration of the cultural milieu of the time and an examination of two examples of the admonitions to women in Seder Nashim, specifically the negative view of going out to search, found in the introduction, and the multiple admonitions against saying palabras de cabeza, literally words of the head, but referring to additional personal prayers said at times for ritual blessings. 16th century Salonika, a port city with mercantile ties throughout the Ottoman Empire, was home to a diverse population of Jews. Romania Jews had lived in Salonika for centuries, and they followed different customs than the Sephardim, and they spoke Yavanic Greek, not Ladino. Salonika was home also to a small Ashkenaz population, and as part of the Ottoman Empire, a Muslim population. Successive waves of exiles from the Iberian Peninsula, occurring pre-1492, in 1492 after Spain's edict of expulsion, and again in the early 16th century from Portugal, brought Jews with varying degrees of religious training, including some, as Jonathan Ray has documented, who claimed either Christian or Jewish affiliation, depending upon their perceptions of the exigencies of time and place. The demographics of exile created a society in which many Jewish men and women not only lacked formal training in prayer and ritual, but also lacked a clear sense of Jewish identity and communal cohesion. In the first generations of exiles in Salonika, identity derived primarily from the place of origin and traditional customs, minhagim. Evidence for this can be found in the multiple synagogues identified by the Iberian town or region left behind after exile, as examples Barcelona, Toledo, Valencia, Catalonia, Portugal, and in rabbinic writings that focused on the differences in customary practices among various groups. David ibn Abi Zimri, a leading rabbi among the first generation exiles, wrote, and I quote, "And it is the custom throughout the Jewish diaspora that Jews who are of the same city of origin or language make a community for themselves, and they do not mix with men of a different city or region." And explaining further, when Jews broke away from their communities and languages of origin, quote, "there is also a corresponding breaking up of devout hearts." By the time Seder Nashim was published, smaller congregational communities were being subsumed into larger, more politically and economically viable ones, but the tensions regarding language and customary practices remained. When its introduction positions Seder Nashim as a means of protecting against women going out to search, it gestures to the biblical story of Dina, who went out to see the daughters of the land with disastrous results, and the long tradition of rabbinic anxieties about assimilation that are reflected in teachings against women going out, as in, for example, Genesis Rabbah. While it would then be easy to read this as a traditional patriarchal view, requiring women to remain secluded at home, to do so would ignore the long tradition of pre-expulsion Iberia of Jewish women's involvement in public activities, including commerce and finance. And I suggest that we might read this admonition as a reflection of the tensions posed by life in Salonika among multiple Jewish communities with differing customs and the very real issues that those customs presented. Consider the different traditions concerning marriage among Sfardim and Romaniot. To take just one example, the question of whether the exchange of gifts between a man and woman who wanted to marry merely anticipated a formal marriage or in fact constituted the actual marriage was the subject of multiple rabbinic responsa. In the process of negotiating and formalizing a marriage, Romaniot Jews gave gifts, siblanot, after Kiddushin. Therefore, for the Romaniot, any woman who had received siblanot was considered to be legally married. The Sfardim of Salonika, however, had the custom of giving siblanot before Kiddushin, thus meaning that a woman was not legally bound merely by the giving and acceptance of gifts. What was the import of these differing customs? Well, if an engagement was terminated between Sephardic Jews after the exchange of gifts but before Kiddushin, it probably resulted in heartache and embarrassment, but according to the Romaniot Minhag, it actually required a formal divorce, a get, with all the attendant issues that that legal process could bring to bear. Numerous responsa considered the questions of intermarriage between these two groups, and in 1509, the Sephardic rabbi Yaakov ibn Habib, in a lengthy responsa, which also reveals the anxieties of believing that there were few true rabbis of learning among the generation of exile, responds to the issue about siblanot, concluding, "Our thinking is not like the thinking of those who suspect with regard to siblanot, nor is their way our way." How frequently would this kind of issue arise? Again, consider the societal ruptures and displacement caused by exile. Describing the lives of the exiles, Rabbi Abraham Shamsolo wrote, "Men arrived without their wives and women without their husbands. They were beset by poverty and travail, want and famine and loneliness, and their cares broke their strength. But when one found himself alone, he sought a helpmate, and they found a way to obtain what they needed. And as they assembled, men and women courted without respect to lineage and social standing." And all this before we even consider the risks and temptations of life in a port city with a large itinerant population. In 16th century Salonika, then, the risks posed by Sephardic women and girls going out included not just the issue of attraction to non-Jews, but also that they might become involved with Jews from a different community with different customs and language, and thereby further fragmenting the tentative and fragile cohesion of Sephardic identity. By providing what we might view as a woman's version of the Shulchan Aruch, its author created a simultaneously radical and yet deeply conservative treatise on women's religious practices. It's somewhat radical when compared with other, quote, women's books of prayer or entertainment, in its insistence that women were obligated to observe halakhic norms and its provision of a means of educating them in those responsibilities. But it was also deeply conservative in its insistence upon a strict category of permissible prayers and its repeated admonition, y no añada más palabras, and do not add any words when providing prayers to say. There was a long tradition in Judaism of women adding personal prayers, usually for the health and well-being of their families, as they lit Shabbat candles or observed other rituals. An early Iberian prayer for Shabbat candle lighting stated, "Lord, enlighten my fortune and my children towards your obedience. Illuminate them in your presence. Place them among the people of learning, practice, fear of God, and knowledge. Keep forbidden things far away from our home. Make our children grow to Torah and good deeds." In contrast, Seder Nashim provides the blessing in Ladino that would be familiar to us, Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, ruler of the universe, who sanctifies us with commandments and commands us to light the candles of Shabbat. In the prescribed prayer, the emphasis is on Adonai in fulfilling the commandment. In the earlier women's prayer, the emphasis is on petitioning Adonai to protect the well-being of the women's children and to keep them on the right path. Rabbi Benvenisti characterizes these kinds of personal prayers as palabras de cabeza, in other words, made-up prayers, and he repeatedly insists in his book that they not be said. He provides, for example, a bedtime prayer for night that includes a petition to Adonai, God of my fathers, to increase my appetite for good and do not increase my appetite for bad and protect me from Satan. And further, to ask for protection from sueños malos y pensamientos malos, bad dreams and bad thoughts. But compare that prayer with a traditional Sephardic women's prayer that was recorded in the 18th century but has now been traced to pre-expulsion Iberia. I lie down in my bed, protected by Miriam the prophetess. I am covered with the quilt of Solomon the king. I give up my soul to the power of the Lord. May he keep it safe from flames of fire and from sudden death. I close my doors and windows with King Solomon's seal. Michael is on my right hand and Gabriel on my left, and the Spirit of God above my head. Keep me safe from evil poison and from bad sickness. Save me from misfortune and keep me free from danger. This woman's prayer draws on a rich repertoire of traditions, combining images from Judaism with magical practices, such as the sealing of doors and windows. It also focuses on very specific physical dangers, such as fire, sudden death, poison, sickness, and misfortune. In contrast, Seder Nashim focuses on the moral status and ethical well-being of the woman praying, asking that she desire good, not bad, and that she be protected from Satan. In contrast, the traditional women's prayer focuses not on moral development, but on the quotidian dangers of early modern life. And it does so by actually incorporating Jewish traditions on invoking four angels, Michael, Gabriel, Uriel, and Raphael, and the Shekinah for protection, which are found in the prayer before bed, the Kriyat Shema Al Hamitah, that men were obligated to recite. Rabbi Benveniste follows the rabbinic view that women were exempt from reciting this formal Kriyat Shema since it was a time-bound commandment, but instead provides a prayer for women that has no mention of angels or the Shekinah. Sephardic women's prayer practices that blend elements of rabbinic traditions combined with concern for the interests inherent in their lives as mothers, wives, and daughters is also found in Sephardic ballads and koplas that recast biblical stories in ways that incorporated midrash and folk elements to create women's songs. Various versions of the Sephardic ballad El Robo de Dina, for example, reject the image of the biblical Dina as wanton by going out that was reflected in Genesis Rabbah and later rabbinic writings, and instead portray her as a beautiful and, most important, virtuous young woman. Seder Nashim is deeply affirmative of the importance of women in the preservation of Jewish identity and the need for education of women in Jewish ritual, but at the same time it highlights rabbinic discomfort with and disapproval of women's prayer practices. So this has been really an exceedingly brief introduction to Seder Nashim because of time constraints. But if, as I have posited, we should understand Seder Nashim as its author's response to the ruptures in Jewish life caused by exile and its aftermath, then I think we must also recognize that it specifically rejects many of the very practices that fostered Jewish identity for Sephardic women, both pre and post expulsion. This complex and ever-fraught issue of Jewish identity is highlighted in this early post-expulsion generations, and both Seder Nashim and the whole panorama of Sephardic women's religious practices merit much further study.
Hello everyone. I want to thank those who organized this conference and GTU for having me here. It's nice to get out of Palo Alto for one day, so I'm especially excited to be in Berkeley. So despite being deeply rooted in Iranian history for over 2,000 years, Iranian Jews are one of the least well-studied Jewish populations. Therefore, for my presentation today, I'll be focusing on literature, mostly historical, on the Iranian Jews. I'll be focusing mostly on the 19th and 20th centuries, but I'll start in the 16th century for this presentation. So there's four themes that receive a lot of historical focus on the Jews of Iran, and I'll be focusing on those. The first theme pertains to how Shiism as a state-sanctioned religion in Iran affected the lives of Jews. The second theme is the pervasive conversion of Jews to the Baha'i faith in Iran in the late 19th century. The third is the condition and status of Jews under the Pahlavi regime or dynasty in Iran, which is from 1925 to 1979. And lastly, the study of Iranian Jews in the diaspora. The majority of the historiography on Jews in Iran is greatly flawed, and it falls prey often to a lachrymose understanding of Jewish history. There's also much more work to be done, but I'll end the presentation by looking at some good work that has been recently published and some new and exciting directions that I'd like to take this research in. So first, as I said, I'll be discussing Shiism. The Topic historians of Iranian Jewry in the Safavid dynasty, which was established in 1501, focused primarily on is Jews' dhimmi status, or as we Iranians would say, zemmi, because there's no tha in Farsi, and what implications this had on their lives. The official implementation of Shi law as state-sanctioned religious law in Iran in 1501 is posited as one of the most crucial moments in the history of Jews in Iran. In Dhimmi Status and Jewish Rules in Iranian Society, Lawrence Loeb argues that after this shift in religious law, Jews were treated like second-class citizens. During the reign of Shah Abbas I, from 1587 to 1629, for example, Jews were required to wear conspicuous religious external markers, such as colored patches and non-matching shoes. But it's important to note that these markers or these regulations were never very strictly enforced, nor were they ever permanent. On a broader level, Loeb and a number of other scholars on this topic say that the Shiism contributed to experiences of mass expulsion, murder, cruelty, and forced conversion to Islam. This literature focuses primarily on the impurity laws instituted by the Shi rulers in Iran. Daniel Tzadik at Yeshiva University notes that some of the most prominent Muslim jurists in Iran, even in the 19th century, declared non-Muslims, specifically Jews, to be impure. Impurity was understood, even in the 19th century, as something tangible and transferable. So for example, I mean, it reaches very ridiculous heights. Because of a law that stipulated that water was a carrier of impurity, Jews on days when it was raining were not allowed to go outside lest the water splash off of them onto Muslims. And actually I read a really interesting oral history about this in which a mother in the early 20th century goes to her son's school and pleads with the headmaster, please let my son attend school because apparently it had been raining a lot and he was missing a lot of school. One serious flaw of this literature is that its overwhelming focus on Jewish persecution often suffers from portraying the Jewish experience as exceptional, rather than as part of a larger historical moment of discrimination against all non-Shi religious minorities in Safavid Iran, whether they be Zoroastrian, Sunni, Jewish, or Christian. Furthermore, this literature's heavy focus on the suffering of Jews during the Safavid and Qajar dynasty overlooks instances where there was not only positive dialogue between Jews and Muslims, but also where Jews were prominent in lucrative fields such as diamond trade. In other words, it creates an understanding of Iranian Jewish history from the 16th century to the turn of the 20th century as an unending chain of suffering and persecution. Next, I'll talk about the conversion of Jews to the Baha'i faith. Mirza Hussein Ali Nuri Baha'u'llah was the founder of the Baha'i faith. He lived from 1817 to 1892. He claimed to be the messenger of God. He began to preach his messianic declaration of the coming of the new age and his modernizing beliefs starting in the second half of the 19th century. The Baha'i faith that emerged was considered and continues to be considered by Islam as blasphemous. There are a number of reasons for this, but the main reason is that it posits that a messiah came, or a prophet came after Muhammad, which is a great sin in Islam, of course. Abbas Amanat at Yale comments that in the second half of the 19th century, up until the 20th century, there were recurrent instances of anti-Baha'i campaigns instigated or sanctioned by Shi clerical rulers and were often condoned by the different rulers of the Qajar and Pahlavi dynasties. Baha'u'llah persuaded his followers to go to parts of Iran in which there were no communities of Baha'is to convert them. Considered very modern, combined with the personalities of charismatic teachers, the Baha'i faith experienced a steady rise in numbers during the founder's lifetime and also following up until about the first few decades of the 20th century. Baha'i communities of Iran grew rapidly, and during this period of growth, massive numbers of Jews in the tens of thousands, although getting an accurate estimate would be very difficult, converted to the Baha'i faith. Mehrdad Amanat writes that this massive conversion is very important because Jews had never converted to any religion besides Islam in such large numbers during their history in Iran. The largest conundrum about this massive and pervasive conversion of Jews to the Baha'i faith in the 19th century, which often started with some of the most prominent Jews converting, like doctors, is why a faith that already experienced intermittent bouts of persecution, and in the late 19th century, there were a number of instances of blood libels, and this is around the time when Jews were converting. So why would these Jews convert to a religion that wasn't even protected under the Mi status? In other words, why would Jews convert to a religion under which they knew they'd experience far worse persecution? And Jews understood that they'd be experienced persecution. It's not as if there wasn't an understanding at this time, because the persecution and discrimination against Baha'is emerged basically when the religion itself emerged. So what were the internal and external factors leading to the receptivity of conversion to the Baha'i faith? Amonat offers a few hypotheses as to why Jews were more susceptible than any other religious minority, and really they converted in much larger numbers than any other religious minorities, to the Baha'i faith. He states, for one thing, that some economic changes in the 19th century caused a deterioration in the condition of the Jews in communities all over Iran, when the Jews' thriving textile industry and trade was corrupted by the incursion of cheap European goods. This crisis, he argues, may have contributed to their receptivity to conversion. Furthermore, he talks about a very important messianic expectation among Iranian Jews at the time that may have made them more likely to convert. But he doesn't say where this messianic fervor comes from, nor why was it at this particular historical moment that it was so prevalent. More than anything, he says, the novelty of its religious message was what held its largest appeal. So a call for the equality of all races, it had this very universalist outlook, and it didn't require Jews to relinquish their Jewish heritage. So for example, he posits that when Jews would convert to Islam, they were still treated as second-class citizens and viewed with suspicion by Muslims, and they had to kind of cut off their ties mostly with the Jewish community. On the other hand, when they were to convert to the Baha'i faith, in theory, they wouldn't have to necessarily cut off their ties with their Judaism, because as you probably know, the Baha'i faith mixes lots of different elements from different religions. Ultimately, I believe that these hypotheses are very unconvincing. Why was it at this historical moment that Jews were so compelled to convert? And why would they convert to a religion that Islam detests so much? These questions ultimately do not receive persuasive answers. As such, I believe this is an area that needs a lot more thorough research. Okay, Jews of the Pahlavi dynasty. Levi Habib, who was a prominent Iranian Jewish scholar, posits in his comprehensive history of the Jews of Iran the common Iranian diasporic Jewish notion that life under the Pahlavi, especially under the second Pahlavi ruler, Mohammad Reza Shah, was paradise. Other scholars often corroborate this claim by stating that Jews gained growing liberties under the rule of the Pahlavis. Indeed, if you speak to any Iranian Jew in the US today, many attribute the improvement of the status of Jews to a story very reminiscent of the Royal Alliance. And anecdotally, for example, my mom has always told me the reason that the Shah, meaning the second Pahlavi Shah, was so good to the Jews was because his wife couldn't conceive. And they went to a number of Muslim doctors, and she was still unable to conceive. Only upon going to a Jewish doctor was she able to conceive, because he helped facilitate that. And so this is why the Shah was so good to the Jews. Lior Sternfeld, assistant professor of history and Jewish studies at Penn State, agrees with this assessment, stating that the common Iranian Jewish narrative in the diaspora is that this period was a golden era for Iranian Jews. He adds that Iranian nationalism during this time revolved around cultural roots, language, ethnicity, and Western-style secularism, which at least in theory allowed non-Muslims full membership in the national project. Arlene Dalal-Far, an Iranian Jewish anthropologist who spent a few years in Iran, 2008-2009, studying the Jewish communities who have remained there, says that the Pahlavi era created many opportunities for Jewish Iranians and increased social interactions and intercommunal mixing with non-Jewish Iranians, reinforcing an intrinsic embeddedness of Jews in cultural, social, and economic life. Indeed, Sternfeld notes that the Jewish community did flourish under the Pahlavi dynasty, especially in the 1960s and 1970s. Many Jews became high-ranking bureaucrats, merchants, industrialists, and climbed the social ladder. And they were overrepresented in universities and professional organizations and allowed to practice their faith openly. They also maintained many communal institutions such as synagogues, hospitals, newspapers, and schools. Engagement in such professions brought Jews into contact with the larger non-Jewish Iranian public. David Benashri, a prominent Israeli historian of Iran, who spent a few years in the 1970s, writes, "Jews were overrepresented among the country's student population and university faculty body. Although there were people of low income among them, the vast majority could be defined as middle class or upper middle class, and some were very rich." So the Iranian Jewish novelist Roya Hakakian, who came to the US in 1985 actually, writes, quote, "For nearly half a century, the 100,000 Jews of Iran had been sending a representative of their choice to the Majlis, the Iranian parliament. They were at long last living in any neighborhood they chose. Iran was at the most welcoming to Jews in their entire history." End quote. This scholarship advances a particular image of Jewish life in Iran under the Pahlavi dynasty, in which Jews were prosperous, free, and integrated members of Iranian life. Now I'll turn to Iranian Jewish diasporic literature. An event that has shaped the memory of Iranians, both Jewish and non-Jewish, is the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Which marked a mass emigration of Iranians to the US, Europe, and Canada, but mostly to Los Angeles, which has received the moniker Tehrangeles because of the incredibly large Iranian community there. The Iranian Jewish community faced more severe persecutions during this time, or more an additional threat of being claimed as a Zionist collaborator. Several Jewish community leaders and businessmen were arrested, tortured, and in very few cases executed upon charges of spying for Israel or collaborating with Western powers. These events startled the Jewish community of Iran and prompted many of them to leave in large numbers. However, Hakakian, who I mentioned earlier, says that it wasn't primarily persecution that drove them to leave, but rather decreasing economic opportunities. Most estimates note that there were nearly 100,000 Jews living in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. But with its approach, the Jewish population of Iran decreased drastically. And the estimates of how many people there range from about 10 to 20,000, although again, it's very difficult to establish what that is. In the last few decades, the prominent Iranian Jews Homa and Human Sarshar have collected and recorded a 4-volume Persian book of oral histories called Yahudiyan Irani Dar Tarikh Muaser, or The History of Contemporary Iranian Jews. They include interviews and oral histories with both prominent and lesser known Iranian Jews living in the US and primarily in LA, as I said. So although oral histories can be compromised by the natural precariousness of memory, and you have a lot of people who are in their like 80s and 90s telling these oral histories, I believe these sources are invaluable lessons or lenses into the experience of Iranian Jews in Iran, and also into how they remember their time there decades after they've left. After serving and translating a number of these oral histories, I found that there is a characteristic way in which Iranian Jews tell of their past in Iran. These memories often focus the simultaneous, harmonious, and hostile relationship between Jews and Muslims in Iran. For example, again, anecdotally, there's this story that you find in a lot of places in which you have Jewish communities in the Muslim world, which is when there were pogroms or in hatred or something incited against Jews, and people are like going into the streets and looting and attacking Jews. There's always a few benevolent Muslims who protect the Jews. And so this is kind of, it's a literary trope, but it's of course based upon reality. And you find this cropping up in a lot of these oral histories. So these remembrances then demonstrate that it's untenable to view the history of Iranian Jews as a constant progression of persecution and misfortune, as many scholars have done. I'll now turn to new directions in the study of Iranian Jews. Sternfeld, who I mentioned earlier, has produced fascinating work on Jews in Iran, especially their involvement in political movements in Iran, which very little work has been done on this. Jews were really active in the communist Tudeh Party, and as Sternfeld would argue, actually helped facilitate the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In fact, he studies the Jewish Sapir Charity Hospital in Tehran, which was one of the only hospitals in Tehran at the time that actually helped treat protesters who had been hurt. And incidentally, my father worked there as a doctor for some time before he left. Sternfeld's scholarship, I believe, provides hope that more nuanced literature on Iranian Jews is being written. I'd like to conclude this presentation by discussing some of the projects that would be worthwhile to pursue in examining the history of Jews in Iran in the 20th century. In the last few decades, a number of fascinating and important works about the effects of nationalism and nationalizing campaigns on Sephardi Jews in former Ottoman lands has been produced. In light of this incredibly important research, I'd like to also see how nationalism and westernizing campaigns affected the lives and status of Jews in the 20th century in Iran. I'm also interested to see how this trope that I was talking about of the Royal Alliance and Benevolent Shah can be applied to the Jews of Iran, as it has been applied to other Jewish communities. And lastly, I'm hoping to elucidate the situation of Jews who remained in Iran after the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Virtually no work has been conducted on these topics, and I hope to shed light on them. Thank you.
This presentation, the title, is adapted from my dissertation, which is titled Narrative Remembrance, Close Encounters Between Muslims and Jews in Morocco's Atlas Mountains. And so today it's very much a work in progress, and I'll welcome comments, questions, challenges afterwards. Jews and Muslims lived together throughout the primarily Berber-speaking regions of the Atlas Mountains for centuries, up until the mass emigration of Jews in the 1950s to early 1960s. But despite the totality of the rupture, elder Muslim villagers retain vivid memories of their former neighbors still today. The stories, songs, and jokes that animate these memories illuminate a shared past, the one not devoid of paradox. And there's a map of Morocco, and the regions I worked in were mostly, whoops. There we go. Down, sorry. Marrakesh, but the red is the different Atlas mountain ranges, and I was in the south. Oops, okay. These oral traditions reveal nuances of daily life not present in other sources. As historian Alessandro Portelli writes, oral traditions don't, quote, necessarily tell facts, but reveal truths, not the truths of material events, but of beliefs, experiences, feelings, end quote. As such, the anecdotes give a glimpse into how Jews lived as the only religious minority among a Muslim majority. Jews participated fully in Berber cultural life, yet at the same time sought to protect their identity and difference. Life was a continual negotiation of identities, out of which came humor, creativity, and community. I will present three examples that reflect this social life full of ambivalent laughter, to use Mikhail Bakhtin's words from his famous writing on the carnival. Such laughter is, quote, at once mocking and joyfully reasserting, end quote, and asserts that the one laughing is also being laughed at. The anecdotes I present today were all recounted by Muslim narrators through whom Jewish speech is mediated. My dissertation includes Jewish narrators as well, conversely speaking in or through Muslim voices. By speaking in one another's voices, Muslim and Jewish narrators express multiple and often contradictory meanings, allowing for ambiguity and unresolved tension. Rashid, an 80-year-old Muslim Berber, recounted my first example. I interviewed him in February 2012 at his home in a small village near the town of Talwin, the seat of the regional government. Spring had already arrived. Almond trees lined the river valley in white blossoms, and fava bean plants rose tall and green, striking a verdant contrast to the mostly barren anti-Atlas mountains, as you can see, rising on either side of the valley. Hidden within these mountains are myriad patches of green, signaling the presence of tiny village oases, many of which once harbored small Jewish communities. Rashid had been a poor sharecropper and had also worked closely with Jews in various circumstances. I asked him about Jews' relations with the regional authorities at the time, the Glaoui clan, who were the powerful Berber warlords known for their harsh tyrannical rule over locals. Rashid replied with an anecdote. Moshe Aznag would go directly in to see the Qa'id. Nobody could stop him. A Khalifa asked him, why don't you give me your shishit so that I can get in to see the Qa'id? The shishit was the short conical cap that Jewish men wore as a sign of piety. You can see in the back. Throughout the Atlas Mountains, head coverings were the most visible markers of difference between Muslim men who wore turbans or were bareheaded, and Jewish men. This anecdote plays with the idea of the shishit as an object that can be transferred, transferring identity with it. While the term shishit itself has no religious connotation, it takes on the role of what anthropologist Sherry Ortner calls a summarizing symbol for Jewishness in Berber oral traditions. Quote, summarizing symbols are those symbols which are seen as representing for the participants in a relatively undifferentiated way what the system means to them, unquote. This perception of the shishit allows the Muslim Khalifa to reduce Jewish identity to the wearing of it. The anecdote's tone is ambiguous because the Khalifa, while envying Moshe Aznag's position, implies that it is merely Aznag's Jewishness that gives him access to power, thus denying him any personal ingenuity or individuality. At the same time, the Khalifa is, of course, joking that he could actually disguise himself as a Jew or Aznag by wearing the shishit. Putting on the shishit would neither change the Khalifa's identity nor give him the access he sought. The playfulness of the interaction suggests a degree of intimacy between the two men. It appears to be a business encounter, yet one in which such joking about religious difference is not off limits. The narrator's account also suggests an insult to the Khalifa. Ironically, the Khalifa feels he needs to take on the marker of a person, a Jew, below him in the social hierarchy in order to gain access to one above him, the Qa'id. The anecdote complicates assumptions of minority-majority relations. Here a Jew crosses boundaries in the power structure that Muslims, even those highly placed, could not. This points to the complex and paradoxical position of Jews vis-a-vis the social political hierarchy. Jews were both protected, yet second class, to the Muslim majority as dhimmis, as Daniela mentioned, the status that granted non-Muslim monotheists protection under Islamic rule in exchange for a poll tax and certain markers of a subservient status, which again, as Daniela mentioned, varied greatly geographically and chronologically and in their enforcement. And even more applicable for these regions was the system of tribal protection. In the tribal Atlas Mountains, Jews didn't have their own tribes, but would be under the patronage of a Muslim tribe, as were also weaker Muslim tribes. Jews also aligned with stronger tribes as a survival strategy, and so some of them worked for the Glaoui clan. Of course, this trope, and often reality, of court Jew goes well beyond Morocco. And also, the Jew as advisor to a Muslim appears not only in Moroccan folktales, but all kinds of Jewish literature, but in particularly Moroccan Jewish told ones, the plot revolves around resentment from a Muslim rival. Whereas interestingly, in many Berber Muslim told tales, the plot turns on the wise counsel of the Jewish advisor. Possible resentment by Muslims towards Jews for such alignments was also likely mitigated by the fact that Muslim and Jewish villagers' lives were so interdependent in their efforts to eke out livelihoods, however possible. In Rashid's narration, rather than expressing resentment, it's as if he shares the joke on the Khalifa, siding with the Jewish man's point of view, who he names as someone he knows, whereas he doesn't name the Khalifa. As noted earlier, Rashid occupied the lower echelons of the power hierarchy, both past and present, as a poor landless man, and thus aligns himself with the underdog, the Jewish man in this case, having the upper hand in the joke. The shishit, as summarizing symbol of Jewishness, also appears in fragments of poetic contests remembered throughout the Atlas Mountains. In these, it is represented as such by Jewish poets, at least as recounted by Muslims, as in the next example. But before we look at that, a short note on these sung poetic contests, the Berber version of poetry slams. They were a prevalent form of Berber oral traditions in which both Muslims and Jews participated. The spontaneous poetic contests typically accompanied a traditional communal dance that was performed in the village square to celebrate all kinds of occasions, religious or not, for both Jews and Muslims. The poetry slam served to voice and resolve, if only temporarily, inter or intra-communal tensions, whether due to tribal, religious, or gender differences. A witty response earned admiration for the other from his or her rival and the audience, not to mention greater likelihood of it entering the collective memory. The remembered fragments typically contain a provocation and a retort. With this in mind, let us look at the following exchange, told to me by Muslim women of all generations. Here, it's not the donning of the shishit that grants access, as in the previous anecdote, but rather its removal. A Muslim poet sang, "We share this gathering with Jews. We ask God for forgiveness." A Jewish poet responded, "The shishit is the only difference. It's easy to take off." The Jewish poet's response may seem an uncomfortable solution in which he must give up his Jewish identity marker in order to fit in. Yet, just as suggested in the previous anecdote, that one cannot become Jewish by putting on the shishit, neither can one become not Jewish by taking it off. And Jewish men, in fact, did not give up their head coverings. The first line appears in variations with some frequency in Muslims' remembered fragments. It reflects ambivalent attitudes between Jews and Muslims and an ongoing tension between affiliation and differentiation. While on the one hand, the Muslim poet expresses a certain reluctance to share the occasion with Jews, the Jewish poet's response, through the Muslim narrator, expresses the desire to participate, that is, to belong. This attitude is emphasized in Muslim-told anecdotes or poetic contests. whereas I never heard such desire expressed by Jews themselves, who I interviewed. There are a variety of possible implications and interpretations for this, which we can discuss in the Q&A, and I'll welcome your thoughts on that as well. My final example was recounted by another Muslim man, Omar, and goes as followed. Once, the village chief went on the Hajj to Mecca. When he returned, the Muslim villagers all went to his house to pay him a visit. The Jews were embarrassed. They really should go also. So they decided to pay a visit. They took sugar cones and gifts, but the Jews, instead of paying him a visit, instead, they started to sing. "We're just coming to see Lady Arkia, whose hands are beautified by henna designs." And Omar continued, "They went to visit his wife, not him. That means they don't care about Mecca or the Hajj." So I asked, "But they had to go pay a visit?" And Omar answered, "Yes, that's the tradition." This story teases out the sometimes fine line that existed for Jews and Muslims between respecting one another's religion and religious practices and not betraying their own. On the one hand, as suggested by the narrator, the obligation of Jews to visit the chief might have felt to them as if it meant paying tribute to the Hajj itself, that is, one of the five pillars of Islam. Paying tribute to someone who has gone on the Hajj is not prescribed by Jewish law, nor antithetical to one's Jewishness. However, it was perceived to be such by the minority population, at least in the Muslim narrator's telling. On the other hand, it was a social expectation of villagers to celebrate one another's momentous occasions, whether religious or otherwise. By disconnecting the visit from religion, the Jewish villagers found a solution seemingly satisfactory to all parties. Yet, given the patriarchal society, there is also insult to the chief layered into the Jews' action. They feminize their visit by paying respect to the woman of the household rather than the man, which could be taken as an affront to him. However, the act also feminizes the Jewish men in the party, alluding to the special position of Jewish men among Muslims as desexualized. This also points to a different type of access Jewishness allowed men. As tailors or peddlers of household goods, Jewish men were allowed into a Muslim woman's home when no other men of her family were present, whereas this was unthinkable for a Muslim man outside the family. In this anecdote, Jews engaged in a strategy of circumvention that went beyond merely avoiding a show of disrespect to what might be perceived as subversion, barely hiding their lack of deference. Or might the circumvention actually be a form of respect? And actually, in the chapter before this one in my dissertation, I focus on the constant interplay of insult and respect. Again, as in the earlier anecdote of Aznag and the Khalifa, ambiguity contributes to the humor. Were the Jews really going to see the village chief and only jokingly singing about Lady Layla Rakia as a way of announcing that the visit was not religious? Either way, such strategies were not lost on their Muslim neighbors, who recount them with delight over half a century later. Thank you.
Well, I for one am quite hopeful about the future of the field, seeing that these are some of the directions it's going.
Emily, could you introduce yourself?
I'll introduce myself. I'm Emily Gottrich from across the street, chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies and a historian of Moroccan Jewry and Muslim-Jewish relations in North Africa and the Islamic world more broadly. Thanks to the two of you for organizing this and to your great staff and so on. I have to start with an apology to Susan, who was so diligent that she sent me her paper so much in advance I forgot all about it and only read the two that came to me like in the last day or two. So I do promise you written notes, okay? And I'm very apologetic for that.
No problem.
Good cautionary.
I know, she's too good a student. I mean, so like I said, I'm gonna have to limit I prepared some comments and I'll limit them to the two other papers. But certainly all three are wonderful representations of new directions in Sephardic studies. However, in terms of these two papers I'll discuss, that direction has decidedly little to do with Sepharad as a place or even as a concept, and I'll talk about this in my own paper later this afternoon. But Sarah and Daniela have presented really fascinating work on two of the most ancient Jewish communities of the MENA, the Middle East and North Africa, in Sarah's case Berber Jews in Morocco, and in Daniela's case Persian Jews in Iran. Both communities not only predate their respective nation states, Morocco and Iran, but also predate the so-called Golden Age of Sepharad, as well as the rise of Islam in the region. Yet under the rubric of Sephardic studies, they're now starting to get the attention they deserve. And let me start with Daniela's paper, which is a wonderful historiographic survey of work on Iranian Jews. And I think that this is always a good place to start determining the lay of the land or the state of the field. And that state, when it comes to histories of Iranian Jews, as Danielle makes clear, is that there simply are not enough, and those that exist are problematic in many cases. I certainly couldn't agree with you more, and I'm thrilled to see that you're working on this topic, and you obviously have the linguistic skills to do it justice. Iran is sometimes an outlier in Middle Eastern Jewish studies, despite having the largest Jewish community of the Islamic world today and throughout much of the past. The main way, as Daniela points out, that work on this topic is sometimes lacking is that it reinforces Lacrimose theories of Jewish history. And as a Moroccan Jewish historian, I myself sometimes fall into this trap, and I'm actually was writing a lecture to talk about Al-Andalus this afternoon in my class, and I drew the parallel of, you know, from east to west, how in the Western Islamic world, tolerance, if you will, was greater for Jews, and in the Eastern Islamic world, when you get towards Shiism in Iran, things are rougher for Jews. And I, after reading a paper, I thought, okay, I can't simplify things quite that much. But I think all of us do fall into this trap of sort of the Shiite Eastern end and the Sunni Western end. And I think it's this strange phenomenon of najes or najesa that you point out, this idea of physical impurity in a transmittable way, which is just so foreign to someone who works on the Maghreb, for instance. About najes, since it is this such a striking distinction, I'd urge you to interrogate the historicity of this phenomenon as much as you can in a really serious way. I've heard a lot of oral testimony about it in the 20th century. You mentioned, I think it's Daniel Sadiq's work, who talks about juristic rulings in the 19th century, but I really wonder where the juristic practices and the social practices meet. Are there futuwa, are there fatwas that would more directly link legal attitudes to actual practice on a local level in a specific place? It always seems like it's the story of my friend of my friend of my friend. So I would like to see a sort of tighter work on that, because it does seem slippery. And I'm reminded of Susan Miller's earlier work on jizya in Morocco. Susan will be here in the afternoon. And sort of how we think about dhimma in these very broad terms. And Sarah mentioned this as well, that the way it was applied and to whom it was applied, and, you know, this varied so much to the point that, you know, even in one town in Morocco, the jizya wouldn't be applied for years and years, then it would get applied all at once, but it wouldn't be applied as a poll tax, which it technically should be, a poll tax on one person's head. Instead, the richest person in the community would pay for everybody, and so on. So I wonder, you know, if similar work can be done on najes. A few minor suggestions on how to do historiographic essays, and this refers probably more to your written paper than what you presented here. I think for us to be able to follow a trajectory in the work, it would be very useful to know a little more about the sources you're talking about, in some ways and a little less about them in other ways that I'll get to in a moment. In terms of knowing more about them, you need to date them. You need to tell us when these things were written, so that
it's
we can.
My first conference presentation, by the way.
Yes, of course. I figured that, but I just had to be, you know, professorial and annoying and say you need footnotes. Also, footnotes or that kind of information would allow us. And there were footnotes in there, but in some cases. But the distinction between popular presses and academic presses, which I think in Iranian Jewish history, there's, you know, with Mazda publishing and so on, and then the oral histories, there's. you know, it's, I think you're struggling a little bit to deal with real academic sources and sort of more popular sources, and I think it would be helpful to really identify that distinction. Now, what I mean when I say a little less information is I think that in describing these works, you actually fall into the trap of identity politics a little bit. And I know for many people this is a good thing, but I've seen it do great harm in our field in terms of determining whose voices are quote-unquote authentic, who can speak for whom, and so on. It might be useful for your reader to know that a novelist or memorialist like Roya Hakakian is herself an Iranian Jew, and that I have no problem with, but I think you undermine the scholarly qualifications of others by voicing your need, and again, this is more in the written paper than in what you presented here, but I saw it a little bit as well in the oral presentation. You're a need to identify them in a similar way. You don't call Lior Sternfeld an Ashkenazi Israeli historian, but you feel the need to identify Irene Dalalfar as an Iranian Jewish anthropologist. It's very hard to know when this is appropriate information, when it isn't, but I think you need to at least ask yourself that question, because it can be problematic. Along similar lines, you use Hakakian as a historian. And she's not. The goals are very different. So you have her a quote from her saying, you know, in all of Iranian history, things were better for the Jews under blah, blah, blah. No historian would say in all of Iranian history. Yeah, and I think that you know, she's a very valuable source. I think, you know, and this gets into also how to use oral histories versus other kinds of histories and so on. But just give some attention to that, because I think it's, if you will, you know, dates and pomegranates, apples and oranges, whatever it is. But these sources have specific strengths. I don't think Hakakian's strength is as a historical record necessarily. But given your interest in memoir and oral history and more traditional text-based history, as you continue to pursue your research into Iranian Jews, I wonder what kind of theoretical lens or lenses you're going to bring to this material. I think memory and nostalgia, like we see in Sarah's work, is one potentially fruitful possibility, but also in Susan's work, you know, the textual analysis is also important. Among the many thematic avenues you mentioned, I really hope you'll pursue the one on the post-revolutionary period. I think this is absolutely fascinating and the least understood. There's a very complex relationship between the Jews, their attitude of the Jews towards the regime and vice versa. Plus, Iran just might be opening up in ways that we couldn't even imagine 3 years ago. So I don't know if you know anything about what archives exist for doing Jewish history in Iran and what their accessibility is, but it would be interesting to know, but I think your timing is quite fortuitous, and I wish you luck. Let me turn quickly to Sarah's paper. It's always a great pleasure to read Sarah's work, and which I'm often called on to do. And this is certainly no exception. I always learn so much from her. This project is obviously further along than Daniela's, and is quite polished, despite what you said in the beginning. I think it was very, very polished. It has a very sophisticated theoretical approach, borrowing from anthropological ideas of dialogism and polyphony to get at what Omar Boom has identified as an absent presence in Moroccan society, particularly in the Berber South, and giving it contours and form through these fascinating stories. She mines these stories to get at the heart of the matter, preserving the local specificity while also alluding to broader themes in both Jewish and Middle Eastern. The gap between social expectations and religious obligations for both Jews and Muslims, the feminization of non-Muslims, the court Jew phenomenon, and so on. She shows how the microcosm fits into the macrocosm of both Moroccan history and Jewish history, but also how it doesn't. So, I mean, this is really a work that does justice to local history and the two larger histories in which it is in dialogue, and that's not easy to do. Sarah's work is above all unexpected. She takes us outside of cities where we usually look for Jews in Sephardic studies and finds a rich Jewish life in these rural areas. And she showed you some images of these places, and they're really unlike anything anywhere else. I mean, they're just, the physical setting themselves are amazing and beautiful, among other things. Also, the memory of Jews in these places is disappearing very, very quickly. So this is extremely important work that you're doing for that reason as well. Sarah shows us how in these settings, local arrangements like tribal alliances are more important than sort of generalized understandings of dhimma. She also shows how class matters in the allegiances that are forged between Jews and Muslims. Again, this is something we know a lot about in cities with Jews' involvement in the Communist Party and workers' movements and so on, but much less so in the rural areas. Now we know much more thanks to Rashid's story, but also other ones. I won't take up too much time, but I'm certainly curious to take you up on your offer to discuss possible interpretations of why Muslims more than Jews express a Jewish desire to participate. I would hazard a guess that it has something to do with Islamic universalism and secessionism and so on, but I don't know. I'd leave that up to you. I have some minor suggestions for improvements, but I will leave that for the moment. I would just make a last suggestion that given the orality of your sources, and particularly the poetry jousts, I wonder if any of the emerging literature on soundscapes is useful to you. I mean, the kind of stuff Charles Hirschkin is working on. I know Rachel Caldwell is also doing some of that in Tunisia, but you probably know more about that field than I do, but it seems like that's something that's important in anthropology, important in Middle Eastern studies and so on, and could be useful here. Anyway, three wonderful papers. The floor is open for comments and discussion. I don't know if any of you want to respond to anything I said. Go ahead.
Why don't we take a few comments, yeah. Then we'll turn to each of you for a kind of response. Is that okay? Whether it's from Adrianople or Salonika or whatever. So there are, in fact, no Romaniots in 1472, and in 1492, you know, we begin the new arrivals. By 1520s or something, there are over 20,000 Jews, mostly of Iberian origin. There is very little evidence, in fact, that there is a Romaniot population. However, the problem is indeed acute, but the acuteness of it is much more in Constantinople, where the Romaniots are actually going to be more or less 50% of the Jewish population until into the 17th century. So a book that's published in Salonika does not necessarily mean, perhaps, that it's addressing the local issue, but it's addressing a much bigger issue, in fact, challenge and inter-Jewish kind of tensions. And the Ashkenazi population is one synagogue, and it's very, very small. So I think it may be useful, perhaps, to zoom out of place of publication and really see it as a real kind of addressing the whole Judeo-Spanish speaking world, because we know a lot of authors from Constantinople, for example, published in Salonika. We know a lot of Salonikans published elsewhere. Indeed, we know that, you know, Italy continues to publish a lot of books from the Sephardi world, and so I think the historical context there may provide some clues into the particular publication of this book. And it could even be that the person who is publishing can be based in Salonika, but is really dealing with this much more acute kind of question that emerges, which actually has been, on the whole, relatively muted in a lot of historiography about the Romaniot presence. It's been assumed that this was, you know, they were swapped, presumably, and they kind of went away, but they didn't really until especially in Istanbul, until the 17th century. So my comment there would be perhaps. perhaps to sort of look at the circulation of printing and go forward in that respect, because it doesn't hold for Salonika.
Thank you. I really appreciate that comment. The sources that I looked at for this is not my dissertation work. It's my dissertation is actually on something very different. It's on medieval processions and Jewish participation in Christian urban rituals. But I had done some very preliminary work on Seder Nashim some time ago, and it seemed like an appropriate topic for this conference. And the sources that I had consulted, it appears, from what you're saying, some of them may have helped contribute to an inaccurate perception of the Romaniot presence there. One of the things that's one of the ongoing puzzles for us is that we really don't know what the popularity of this book was, what its circulation was, or the like. We know that this rabbi, who was the author of it, had multiple different volumes published between 1560 and 1568. But we know very little about him himself. And we don't know what the circulation of it was. But I think that regardless of that, your point is a very good one. And were I expanding this paper into something larger, I really would want to look at kind of the whole Eastern Mediterranean circulation of these kinds of issues. But so thank you very much.
That I wonder if it might, because it seems like such a critical, you know, point of some agreement to have, whether, you know, people are identified as married or not. I'm wondering if that might have arisen out of, maybe not this particular dispute, but this disputes like this, and whether it originated, you know, in what community.
It appears to have originated.
If it's identifiable to know in what community that formula originated.
From my research, it appears to have originated among the among Spanish Jews.
Really?
And actually, Spanish Jews in other rabbinic writings had something of a reputation for always doing things a little differently. And sometimes critiqued for not following the ritual processes exactly the way they should. There's a wonderful article in the book, Women in Water, I think it is, that talks about the fact of Iberian Jewish women, so Spanish Jewish women, and their interpretation of the requirement for a mikveh. And that in the almost over-specific, over-rigidly interpretation of the requirements, they end up just kind of subverting the whole way they're supposed to do it. So it seems that this may, in fact, be something along that line, that you had unique kinds of customs growing up among Spanish Jews, and because of the dialect that's reflected in Seder Nashim, it may, you know, well be that we're talking about a particular area of Spain also. I think it's important that we not assume that all Jews from the Iberian Peninsula followed the same kinds of customs. But it seems that that is where that arose, and then it became a distinct conflict with other customs and provisions.
Sure, yeah. I'll start with the concept of impurity as you had brought up. I think you're right, it's very important to look into the
specificity of this concept, especially because it's something that persists even into the 20th century, which is what I work on primarily. I guess my hesitation with that is when people study impurity laws, or even study like the effects of shiism among Jews, as I was saying, you fall prey to this lachrymose understanding of Jewish history. And so there needs to be a way of talking about this without falling prey to that. And I think that that's very important, something that I think would be valuable to do. I guess I'd like you to expand a little bit upon the identity politics that you were saying that was potentially problematic.
Sure. In the written piece, you identify the anthropologist as mm-hmm. being Iranian Jewish.
Okay.
You identify some of the historians
mm-hmm.
as being Iranian Jewish. You don't say anything about Lior Sternfeld.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder again, you know, I mean, if you're talking about oral history, you're talking experience, that's fine. But, you know, is somebody, to what extent does it still matter who you are when you're a scholar
mm-hmm.
working on something? And I think you can, and there are arguments both ways, obviously, and I
mm-hmm.
think I'm probably in the minority and somewhat, you know, old-fashioned in saying that the scholarship should speak for itself. So, you know, Sarah can say, you know, when many of us who work on Moroccan Jews have Ashkenazi names, does that make us less, you know, capable of understanding this history or something?
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it means different things for women who may carry names that aren't actually their own, and so on. So I think there's a strong, I mean, I don't know how it plays in Iranian Jewish studies, and it does seem like most of the people I know who work in that field are themselves Iranian
mm-hmm.
Jewish, but I think, for instance, in North African Jewish studies, there are all kinds of people in it, and I think that, including many, many Muslims who work
mm-hmm.
on this topic, and I just think we need to move beyond using this kind of nativist criteria.
No, I agree with you, and I guess it's not even a question I had thought about, because
mm-hmm.
there's so little scholarship out there, but I think that that's an interesting question to
mm-hmm.
keep in perspective as I continue working on this topic.
Well, thank you for your careful reading and kind comments, and I do want to hear the suggestions that you didn't mention yet, but I will. And in terms of the emphasis by Muslims in their stories and the poetic Jews on this Jewish desire to belong, it is something I have to explore more, but I'm not sure if this ties into your suggestion or not, but I didn't get this so much in my most recent research, but in the 90s, working on another project, were a lot of tales of Muslims trying to get Jews to convert, and that seems to be sort of this underlying hope all the time, that Islam is, I mean, there was rivalry. Jews, of course, thought Judaism was superior, though they had no desire for Muslims to convert, but Muslims always, there's always that possibility that a Jew might convert. And so it's sort of this fantasy that underlying it all, you know, they really do want to convert and belong fully. So that might be
yeah.
underlying that. I don't know if that fits what
yeah,
you were
I mean,
saying.
Yeah, I
the
think what's so interesting about your work is that not only are you kind of using Muslims' memories to reconstruct a history, you then also have to understand that memory in a different way and try and mediate that, and there's so many different layers that you're dealing with that it gets very complex. But I think it's my guess would be it's exactly that that you know in an Islamic worldview, the Jews should want to be part of the majority,
mm-hmm.
Whereas for the Jews it's not the case.
The opposite. We're
yeah.
always wanting to differentiate.
Yeah,
and yeah. And that yeah is one of the most striking differences in the memories, which unfortunately in this paper I didn't have Jewish mm-hmm. memories, but I do. In the dissertation. So. Okay, thank you. Ooh, perfect timing.
Yeah, so we'll wrap up. Those of you who just trickled in, I imagine you're thinking, oh, we missed an amazing set of presentations.
You did.
For our graduate student presentations, and thank you, Emily, for your response. In a few minutes, we'll begin the next piece of the conference. Probably at around 11.